Support for Pretty Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating 70 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's show, we re-air our early summer conversation with Wayne Salter, North Dakota's Commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Services. He has a business background and is bringing his expertise to the largest branch of North Dakota's state government. But first, we chat again with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane from Dickinson State University. He's our go-to presidential scholar and has a lot on his mind about what's left in this sprint to the finish of this presidential campaign. Dr. Cullinane, welcome back to Main Street.
So nice to be back with you, Craig.
This time around, maybe a little more predictable, except that we've had the whirlwind of Kamala Harris and now the concluded Democratic National Convention. Let's start right there. What was your takeaway from the convention?
Well, I think it was an extravagant affair, like all conventions are. I think it had an all-star lineup. We saw two former presidents. We saw a first lady. We saw, obviously, Michelle and Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. I think very much like the Republican National Convention, it got its point across. We didn't see but Beyonce, which was what everyone was talking about on the night. They were expecting Beyonce to come on stage, but Pink was there. I mean, it was a star-studded affair. And even Donald Trump commented that the room itself looked like it was fun.
Did you gain any new insight into how now this will play out relative to the two candidates? It seems to me that President Trump is trying to hone in, and Vice President candidate Vance is trying to hone in on how they're going to attack the current sitting vice president. Do you agree with that?
I do. J.D. Vance just published an article about immigration and the problems of immigration being squarely at the doorstep of Kamala Harris. I think that's not an easy point to make, but it's one that I think that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance poll highly on, that issue of immigration. Also, the economy as well. They're going to try and attach Kamala Harris to Joe Biden's policies, and particularly the inflation of the last couple of years. And that'll work to a certain extent. But I think what we're seeing in the polling data is that Kamala Harris is not as closely tethered to Biden as Trump and Vance would like her to be.
Given the historical context of this race, has it ever been the case to see a former president running against a sitting vice president in a general election? Has that happened before?
A former president running against a vice president? I don't think that has ever happened before. Looking back, I mean, I'm thinking about Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison running, but that was a president running against a former president. I don't think that's ever happened before. I need to check the history stats, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
And neither could I. What does it mean that we now have a first woman of color running for president of the United States?
Well, I think to some people it's going to mean quite a bit. To some people it's going to be rather meaningless. I think for those people that don't talk about identity politics and don't talk about race and about immigration as such, Kamala Harris's color and her background will not matter as much as politics to some people, policies as well. But for those people that have never seen a person of color running for president outside of Barack Obama or Jesse Jackson, or are pleased to see a person of color running in that position because it reflects themselves. And I think it will matter quite a bit. And let me be really clear about what I mean by this, right? So African-Americans were sort of dropping off for Joe Biden in the weeks and months before he dropped out. Now, that is likely to reverse, I think, with Kamala Harris. African-Americans, both women and men, I've heard men saying, we can't let the women down this time. We need to vote for Kamala Harris. I think African-Americans are going to come out on Election Day and vote for Kamala Harris in a way that they wouldn't have for Joe Biden. So that's how I think it might matter.
RFK Jr. has now dropped out of the race. He was polling, I don't know, 4 or 5% or so, depending on what poll you might want to understand. Will there be an impact from his leaving the race and then throwing his support to President Trump?
I think the only impact that's going to happen with Kennedy dropping out is within his own family. I've seen posts on X and elsewhere that friends and family are abandoning Kennedy for endorsing Donald Trump. I don't think him dropping out is going to have much of a difference in this race at all. I think most of the polling around Kennedy was quite soft. Most of the support was quite soft, which is the reason why he's dropping out, obviously. But also, I just think that he was probably drawing the same number of votes from Democrats as he was from Republicans. So I don't think it's going to have any impact. His family, though, on the other hand, including his wife, has written about how upset they are that he endorsed Donald Trump. So I think there's going to be a personal fallout for him, certainly.
What, if anything new, have you learned about Kamala Harris's choice for a running mate? And of course, that's current Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. What have you learned about him, other than the names of his kids are Gus and Claire?
Yeah, I learned that he thinks turkey is not meat, which is a great clip from a Minnesota State Fair when his daughter expressed herself as a vegetarian, and he said turkey doesn't count. I think Walz, for this part of the world, I mean, he's a Midwesterner, you know, born and raised, and very much a small town guy, you know. I think very relatable. I think, especially for Midwesterners, he's very relatable. Does that mean that Tim Walz is going to turn red states blue? I doubt it, but I do think that he's certainly going to help the race in states like Michigan and Wisconsin. And I think he has, to a certain extent, brought a sort of Midwestern vibe to a race that was very much a coastal battle.
One wonders whether Doug Burgum would have done that for President Trump.
I think it's very possible, too. I mean, I think the difference, though, between Walz and Burgum, you know, Burgum is a very wealthy tech entrepreneur. Walz has a much more folksy Midwestern feel. So I don't know what Burgum have brought that. I think what Burgum would have brought, certainly, is a sense of a centrist politician being on the ticket. And I think Donald Trump's choice of Vance was quite the opposite. He brought not a Trump right-wing senator on board, but a senator who certainly has very strong and outspoken views on immigration and American history.
As we speak today, there are 71 days left until Election Day. A lot of talk about ad buys, significant ad buys from both parties after Labor Day. What are those ads going to focus on, do you believe?
I think for Kamala Harris, we saw this, the sort of things that are going to be the focus, which is reproduction and abortion. That is going to be one of the biggest things to turn out female voters. I have no doubt that her personal story or biography is going to turn out African-American voters, particularly in states like Pennsylvania and Georgia, where the turnout of certain cities will have a meaningful impact on the race. I think she's also going to talk about economics, and I think, you know, there's going to be plenty of talk about immigration as well. She's already put herself forward as a stringent opponent to illegal immigration. I think on Trump's point, the immigration issue is going to be front and center. And then beyond that, I'm not really sure, because what we're seeing is a return of Donald Trump being a little bit more off the cuff. So I think his ad buys are going to be much more reactionary to whatever Kamala Harris is saying. I think what I mean by that is that he's going to try and tamp down any of the things that she's sort of trying to champion in her politics. So I think we'll see more reactive sort of ads from Trump, and I think we're going to see more of the convention sort of advertising from Kamala Harris.
I've been really looking forward to a presidential debate, but now I'm seeing today, within the last 2 hours, that President Trump is hedging his bets about participating. I've asked you this question twice. Are we going to have a presidential debate?
Well, I keep on going back and forth, but if you follow the news today, you see that Brian Fallon, who is a senior advisor to Kamala Harris's campaign, has responded to Donald Trump, who today has said that doesn't matter to him. He will be muted or unmuted. They promised to follow the rules of the last campaign, and now they're changing those rules, Donald Trump says. But he says he doesn't care. He'll do it muted or unmuted. And so Brian Fallon, who's Kamala Harris's campaign, one of her campaign managers, has said, that's it. It's resolved. Everything is now set for September 10th. So if you listen to both Trump and Fallon, this is on. But I think behind the scenes, Trump is maybe equivocating a little bit here and saying he doesn't want to do this. He doesn't want to do this debate with Harris.
Why? Why would he want to do this in what, by all accounts, is a very close race?
It's a very good question. I mean, it's probably for the same reason why he didn't get involved in the primary debates either. There's more to lose by getting involved. I mean, think again about Biden. I mean, Biden, you know, the complete collapse of Biden on that stage torpedoed his campaign. I think Harris is in the ascendancy here in the polling, but Trump has such a strong base that if he just keeps this sort of level, he probably can eke out a win. I think for Harris, she wants to do the campaign because she wants to show that she's the younger candidate, which has been a major issue from the beginning. Trump does not want to come off as being elderly by any stretch. But of course, we know that he is now the oldest ever person to run for president of a major party or nominee of a major party.
Sounds odd to say that based on everything we were talking about just a little over a month ago, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Craig, for you and me, too political, we love politics, right? I mean, this has been the most dramatic thing I've watched unfold probably in my lifetime, barring maybe 2016 when Donald Trump ran for the first time and completely threw the political system out of kilter. So I think, yeah, this is really one of the most dramatic elections in our history.
I'll take you back to 2016 and the way that he positioned, or the way that Hillary Clinton positioned herself against President Trump. Contrast that with how you believe Kamala Harris will try to position herself against President Trump. We heard some talk about penetrating the glass ceiling, but that came from Hillary Clinton more so than it did from Kamala Harris in this past convention.
Yeah, so Hillary Clinton certainly dented the glass ceiling and smashed through the Democratic national, you know, nominating process. However, I think that was very different. Hillary Clinton had so much political baggage from her husband's years as president, but also as being a boogeyman to Republicans. I mean, Republicans absolutely detested Hillary Clinton, whether it was the healthcare reforms that she tried to bring in the 1990s or Benghazi when she was Secretary of State. The baggage was immense. And what Donald Trump was so effective at was creating, you know, well, basically making that boogeyman seem even bigger than it was. Now, he's been completely unable to do that with Kamala Harris at the moment. You know, he's tried to, in some ways, pick at policies that she supported or her California politics, but none of that is stuck in the same way it did with Hillary Clinton. And that's almost certainly a frustration of his campaign, because that is what Donald Trump has been most effective at, whether it's within the Republican Party, you know, by making some of his opponents seem, you know, like lying Ted, you know, the terms that he uses to tailor to certain individuals. He's not yet been able to do that with Kamala Harris. And so that in itself is very different. I think her being a female is almost irrelevant when you think about the relationship with Hillary Clinton. Clinton did break the glass ceiling. Kamala Harris might be the one to just shoot right through the roof, though.
We're enjoying our conversation like we always do with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. He's a professor of history at Dickinson State University and is also the Loman Walton Endowed Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University. What are we going to be talking about 2 weeks from now, Dr. Cullinane?
Well, I can tell you what we're not going to be talking about. We're not going to be talking about Robert Kennedy, which I think is a relief for many people. I do think we're going to be talking about Kamala Harris's policies more, which I think is a great improvement. Particularly, I'm hoping that we'll hear more about her economic policies, her foreign policies, particularly with regard to Ukraine and Israel, but also I think in relation to China too, and how that, if in any way, is different from what Donald Trump's foreign policies are. And finally, on Donald Trump's side, I think we're going to find out whether Donald Trump can go back to his convention persona, which is a little bit more stable and a little less reactionary. Today, we saw Donald Trump talking about the Medal of Honor versus the Medal of Freedom. And this is a return to the old Donald Trump of 2016, where it's a little bit less, you know, on message. So today he said that the Medal of Freedom, which is a civilian award, is much better than the Medal of Honor. And we've seen already people coming out saying, well, that's like John Kelly, for example, his former chief of staff has come out to say, that's not true and that's not right. But I think if we can see Donald Trump move back to that idea of unity and that idea of stability, then he has a better chance of winning. If he continues to go in unscripted rants, then that doesn't bode well for his campaign, I don't think.
What about the Harris side? What are we going to be talking about relative to her and the accusation that she hasn't set for a major network or a major journalism-based interview? Is that sticking? And she says that will change.
I mean, if the debate comes off and they have a scheduled debate for September 10th, which is only 2 weeks away, if that is scheduled and set, then I don't think it matters if she does a national interview. However, if for any reason Donald Trump and Kamala Harris cannot agree on a debate, she's going to have to do a ton of interviews. I mean, you could imagine her lining up with Stephanopoulos or with other reporters to do the same kind of interviews that Donald Trump has done, because At that point, it will become the elephant in the room that she's not done these sort of interviews before. But do I think that she's incapable of doing them? No. I mean, she's done loads of these in the past, whether as a vice president, as a senator. So I'm not, I don't really think that's going to be a big deal, but let's wait and see what happens with the debate before we turn to the interviews.
I look at it almost like the convention that her party just put on a month ago. They didn't even know they were going to do it in the way they did it. And it, by all accounts, they pulled it off. Now, is she turning the page as saying, okay, now I've got to do this or I've got to do that. We've got the convention behind us. It surprised me that she didn't go right out on the trail, quite frankly, and she won't do that apparently until Wednesday.
You know, a couple of things that have surprised me about this campaign. I mean, obviously the ones that everyone knows, but in terms of the actual field campaigning where candidates go out into the field and ask people to vote for them, the way it used to be done, I mean, I think about Bill Clinton going to diners, you know, and sitting down and sharing some food with people. And that was certainly the way it works in primaries as well, you know, pressing the flesh, as they say. What it's turned into now is really the Democrats emulating a lot of Donald Trump's tactics. So mass rallies with Tim Walz and Kamala Harris. That seems to be the way that this campaign is playing out. And the Democrats seem as energized by it as the Republicans do. What also, I think, is important to think about in this like really condensed time period is that October surprises will still happen and they're going to happen quick and fast. So something will come along and maybe it's September, maybe it's October, but something will come along that surprises us. I mean, you could think back to 2016 when Hillary Clinton collapsed at a campaign event and everyone was questioning her health and well-being, whether she was able to do the job. I mean, I think that moment really torpedoed her candidacy in a lot of ways. Will something similar happen? I think it's always likely that you can expect a surprise somewhere along the line.
We were chatting with some friends remotely over the weekend here, and the chatter went to, boy, all the former presidents turned out. And I said, no, they didn't. Well, what do you mean? Well, we didn't hear from President Bush, did we? Did that strike you at all that he has been really silent in this debate? Does that surprise you or was it expected?
No, I think that was entirely expected. President Bush, I can't imagine Bush would be supporting Donald Trump. There's so much that had happened with his brother Jeb, of course, in 2016. Trump really annihilated Jeb Bush in the primaries, both on a personal level, but also on a political level as well. And so I think that is not sat well with the Bush family. But also, I don't think Donald Trump needs establishment figures like former presidents in his campaign. His campaign has very much been one of a sort of renegade campaign that is not part of the establishment. So having a president would almost, like a former president like Bush, would almost make it seem too establishment. Some people might like that, but I think the Trump's base would prefer him to stay away from that kind of politics.
About media and communications now for the next few days, the next 71 days. I believe it's the case that more will be spent on non-traditional means of advertising than the traditional network buys, for example, as we head down the home stretch here. Does that surprise you? It doesn't surprise me at all, but who are the main targets that each candidate is trying to go after? You talked about perhaps African-Americans and Kamala Harris. Who really is Donald Trump trying to target that's not part of his base as we speak, would you say?
Well, I think he would like to target African-Americans a bit more, but I don't think he's had much success. So whether his ad revenue goes to that is really unclear. I think the use of social media is still there and apparent. Kamala Harris's campaign has made great use of TikTok. I think, obviously, Donald Trump has his own social media network, Truth Social, and that is putting out messages on a daily basis. And he's back on X now as well. So I think social media will play a part. However, I think the demographics there really matter. So I think the reason why Kamala Harris is using TikTok is simply because that's where younger voters are likely to be. So that's why that ad spend is being utilized. I still think at the end of the day, traditional advertising, whether it be bumper stickers or lawn signs, is going to matter. And that costs money. I think getting out the vote, all of that field campaigning is really expensive and will matter too. I mean, can the Republicans turn out voters in rural parts of Pennsylvania? And can Democrats turn out urban voters in Pennsylvania? I think the answer to that question wins the election, because the 19 electoral college votes of just Pennsylvania seem absolutely critical to either side. So field campaigning might get a revival in a year that getting out the vote is going to be so central to winning that state.
When candidates enlist volunteers to help with their debates, it's something that we really don't witness a lot here in North Dakota. At least that's my perception being relatively new here. And it was also, I think, the case in Wyoming. I think, though, in somewhere like Pennsylvania, it's different. And it's different today because people know who the undecided voters are before they go out a door knocking. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I can bring to bear a little bit of experience in this. I worked for two field campaigns in New York City and in northern New Jersey when I was in my 20s. I was a coordinator in a county. And getting out the vote is extremely important to urban campaigns. So not only have you knocked on everyone's door in every district in that county, but you've also determined whether they're likely Republican or likely Democrat voter. And then you can turn out that voter by either busing them to a polling station or finding out what church they go to and then getting the whole church to go to vote. So this is an immense operation that costs millions and millions of dollars, especially in urban areas. And for the most part, these are areas where Democrats do better than Republicans. And so they really have to put a major emphasis on those field campaigns, whereas in rural areas, it's a lot harder to do that kind of work.
I really think I've heard you say now for our last two interviews that it's all about Pennsylvania. If it's not going to be about Pennsylvania, what's the second state that is just going to be critical? And I'll make the claim that it's Wisconsin.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's an interesting one, because I think Wisconsin is now in the blue camp. I think with Tim Walz being so close, the Minnesota governor, I think Wisconsin is looking bluer than it has. I think Michigan is also looking very blue. I think states like Arizona and Georgia are the two that I would pick that are must wins for Donald Trump. If he doesn't win Georgia, the path to 270 seems really difficult. And if you recall in 2020, that was a state that Democrats were really able to push up vote counts in places like Fulton County, which is, you know, Atlanta area, and some southern counties as well. If they can turn up the volume in those urban areas, Democrats could win Georgia, possibly. Arizona seems really close as well. And while it's got less electoral votes, I believe it's 11 votes in Arizona, it's still a major, you know, gem for either the Democrats or the Republicans to win. And they're going to want to do the same strategy there. Democrats are going to want to drive up the urban vote, and Republicans are going to want to drive up those rural voters.
Speaking of Arizona, as we wrap it up, what did you think when Gabby Gifford made the stage at the Democratic convention?
I mean, I do think that Gabby Gifford is an American hero. I mean, for a lot of reasons, you know, but I think getting up on stage as a victim of gun violence and also being someone that's in the public eye still, but has real difficulties speaking is a heroic gesture. You know, I think there's other people that have taken bullets while in Congress. Steve Scalise comes to mind. You know, he was shot, and he's also heroic. I mean, he gets up and speaks as a majority leader very often as well. But for me, I just think that Gabby Giffords, you know, is a remarkable individual. Her husband, Mark Kelly, is also remarkable. I mean, so I think those are the sort of stories that we do need to talk more about. These people who have overcome great, almost, you know, unbelievable odds to survive.
I can't wait to see the polling.
So I checked on 538 today, and they're putting Kamala Harris about a point and a half ahead of Trump, because what they're doing is they're discounting some of the Republican polls that have come out in the last couple of days. What you want to believe of that, you know, I don't know, but it looks like there was three polls by a company called SoCal that are a little bit dubious, that are skewing things like Real Clear Politics.
I think we'll circle September 11th to have our next conversation, and I really hope it's following the debate that happened the night before. Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane, he's with the School of Education and a professor of history at Dickinson State University, where he is the Loman Walton Endowed Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies. Always a pleasure, Dr. Cullinane.
Thanks, Greg.
Coming up on Main Street, we re-air our early summer conversation with Wayne Salter. He's relatively new on the job and is North Dakota's Commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Services. That's after this.
The FM Kicks Band will conclude their summer jazz series with a performance for Greater Moorhead Days at Viking Ship Park, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. September 7th. Lawnchairs recommended. Details at fmkicksband.com. The Kicks Band receives funding from the Arts Partnership with support from the cities of Fargo, Moorhead, and West Fargo.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Earlier this summer, we visited with Wayne Salter. He has recently taken on the role of North Dakota's Commissioner of Health and Human Services. Despite being in the position for just a few months, Salter, known for his business acumen, has ambitious plans for the state's largest agency. Commissioner Salter, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
You were appointed as the Executive Director of the Department of Health and Human Services just this past January. You have come here from Texas via Florida or Florida via Texas. What brought you to North Dakota?
Well, you know, I'm known for doing some unorthodox things, and I think this is one of those things of really continuing my career of making a difference in the lives of individuals. North Dakota had a commissioner's opening. It was a larger scope of responsibility, but it really fit within my journey and my passion to serve individuals.
Give us a little history of your background relative to business practices of large organizations and governmental organizations. Is that your specialty?
Absolutely. You know, I started in government back in 1997 with the Florida Department of Children and Families. I'll date myself. I walked into the organization as a food stamp cashier, and we were much like bank tellers. It was our role to count millions of dollars of food coupons, mail them out to food recipients. I stayed with the Florida Department of Children and Families for over 17 years. I served in key roles, including the statewide call center director. I had call centers in three locations, Miami, Tampa, and Jacksonville, over 600 employees. I served as the Bureau Chief of Policy. I also served as the Deputy Director and as the Interim Director. In 2014, I answered the call to go to the great state of Texas. They were looking to do some business process redesign, and that's something that I'd been very instrumental in doing in the state of Florida. We had done it several times. And they were looking for a Director of Innovation. And so I originally was interested in doing that. But they reached out and said, we need an associate commissioner for operations. And my first response was absolutely not. It was about 10,000 staff. I was looking to lessen my workload, and this was essentially increasing it. But I flew out to Texas, had some conversations. You know, I looked at their business model and I said, wow, this is an opportunity to innovate. I went to Texas in 2014 as the associate commissioner for the Office of Social Services. In 2017, Texas was directed by the state legislature to merge five agencies into one. And at that time, I was appointed as the Deputy Executive Commissioner of Access and Eligibility Services. I still maintain approximately 10,000 staff, and I did that for approximately 7 years. And then it was time for another change. And so, you know, answered the call to come to North Dakota, again, to continue the journey of helping people be the best version of who they could be.
If you were to summarize for me the governor and the cabinet's marching orders for you relative to the Department of Health, what would you say?
Absolutely. It was apparent out the gate that their mindset was serving people, and they wanted a leader, A, who could motivate the agency to move forward, a leader who definitely had a heart and a passion for serving, and a leader who wasn't afraid to take risks in care and concern for the people.
Let's get into some of the nuts and bolts of what you've already started to do. Let's talk Medicaid renewal work that your office has done. You've completed now a 13-month federal initiative to determine eligibility for folks who coverage was temporarily extended because of COVID, but then needed to do some work to continue their coverage. What was in that process?
Oh, absolutely. This was an unprecedented event for our agency. We, within a 13-month period of time, had to renew the eligibility of over 134,000 individuals. And what that means is that meant our Medicaid workload increased by 50%. Not only did the Medicaid workload increase by 50%, but we also had to maintain, you know, processing for other programs such as SNAP and TANF. I will say that it had a direct impact on programs such as SNAP. You know, shortly after my appointment in January, we received a letter from USDA FNS saying that our processing timeliness for SNAP was unacceptable. And honestly, it was. It was at 55%, which means that we were processing only 55% of all SNAP applications and renewals timely. The federal time standard is 95%. You know, being new to the state, I reached out to our zone partners and we had a meeting. I will be transparent. It was a very frank meeting, but we left that meeting with the understanding and with the agreement that this is unacceptable and we all have to do better by North Dakotans. And you know, if you will, you know, being up in farm country, we put our hands to the plow and we implemented some very aggressive strategies to really do that, to do better by North Dakotans. And in a 3-month period of time, if you look from March to June, we processed through those enhanced strategies an additional 38,000 applications and renewals. And that really is the power of when partnership comes into play, when we get out of the way and really let the essence of power of partnership come forward, you know, great things can happen. You know, I was proud to announce, you know, the other day that we are now at 93% timeliness, and that is absolutely phenomenal. To go from 55% in January to 93% as of today, kudos to our state team, kudos to the zone directors. They did a phenomenal job. I even had an opportunity to meet with all of the eligibility workers who work in the zone. You know, and I really shared with them, like, we are responsible for the lives of people, and they depend on us. It was a rallying cry, and I tell you, those individuals stepped up to the plate, and that 93% is indicative of the work that they have done.
Are there still people out there who lost Medicaid coverage post-COVID that you need to reach?
You know, part of it is on the onus of the recipient. We reached out to everyone who was on our Medicaid rolls. And so, of course, we had individuals who responded and individuals who did not respond. But we have done due diligence in notifying them of the requirement. For the ones who lost coverage, you know, all is not lost. We actually automatically refer them to the federal marketplace to look at some Medicaid subsidies. So we do think over the next period of 3 to 4 months, we will have some individuals who will churn back in. You know, it's been 4 years that we've been sustaining coverage. You know, we've been saying we're going to start the renewal process. We had to get official notification from CMS. And that kind of, you know, comes like junk mail eventually. You know, you don't really check it. You don't really pay attention to it until you go to use it and it's not there. But thankfully, you know, if that occurs, you know, being that we are moving our timeliness needle, we shouldn't have an issue with restarting anybody's coverage. And the beautiful thing about Medicaid, we can retroact coverage for 3 months. So if someone experienced a gap because they did not respond and they come back and they have medical bills, as long as they provide verification of those bills, we can go back 3 months and make sure that they're made whole.
Before we move on, generally speaking, are the number of folks needing Medicaid in North Dakota staying flat about now, dropping a little bit or rising a little bit? Do you know?
Well, throughout the pandemic, it's really kind of hard to gauge it. You know, before it was pretty much flat. Now we've seen an increase, and that's because of the artificial inflation of our rolls because we had to ensure continuous eligibility. So we definitely expect to see, you know, as we start peeling people off of the rolls, it should get back to some sense of normal. I really think it's going to take another 6 months to a year to kind of figure out what our recalibrated Medicaid caseloads will look like.
Let's move on and talk about SHIP, Commissioner. It's an initiative from the Health and Human Services Department. The mnemonic is for the State Health Improvement Plan that's now been launched. We're going to talk about a business plan here in just a minute. What's SHIP and what should North Dakotans know about it?
Absolutely. So SHIP is really an extension of our inaugural business plan. And what that really means, it is the external vehicle to our organization where community partners, constituents, providers, our tribes, where they can all play a role in helping to make North Dakota the healthiest state. When we look at health, it is not just the responsibility of the health department. It is a responsibility of everyone, from public institution, corrections. It really is a holistic approach. And so this SHIP really is the vehicle that reaches out to all of those partners of saying, here's our goal. Here's where we intend to go. Here's what health looks like. We need your help. We solicit your partnership. And I think it's an excellent, excellent vehicle for doing it. It's an innovative approach to bringing people into the vision of making North Dakota the healthiest state in the nation.
And the SHIP isn't something that has just appeared. There's been some work on this over the last several months and years.
Absolutely. This is a multi-year initiative. You know, I will tell you, I met with the team who was responsible for pulling this together, and they have done a phenomenal job at, you know, stakeholder engagement. I mean, they've engaged everybody from corrections, tribes, providers, teachers, public citizens, really to get input. Again, we're trying trying to capture every aspect of what health means to the state and really engaging that, you know, that large constituency, it really gives us a picture of the diverse needs and what we need to do, the programs we need to develop, the policies that need to be implemented. And this is all from, you know, citizens and constituents' feedback.
Your office now is about to launch its first ever Health and Human Services business plan, and it's expected to impact public health services in North Dakota, like you alluded to just a moment ago. What is that business plan?
This business plan really is our reintroduction back into the community as an integrated agency. You know, as you're aware, over a year and a half ago, we merged the legacy Department of Public Health, Department of Human Services into one, what some people will call a super agency. We are the largest state agency. And we don't take that lightly. We understand the weight of our existence and the weight of the things that we need to do. By way of this business plan, we are looking to reintroduce ourselves to the community. People need to know who we are. They need to know what we do. They need to know how we're going to do it. They need to know what that means for them. And this business plan is going to do that. We have over 150 projects and initiatives that are all geared towards our vision of making North Dakota the healthiest state, but really creating better outcomes for North Dakotans. So everything from customer engagement, everything from client education, everything from expanding access to care, everything from providing services to children, to eradicating chronic diseases. We're going to have initiatives in that plan that's going to lead towards that. And how the SHIP actually intersects with that, you know, we understand as an agency, we can't totally eradicate chronic disease. It takes effort. It takes personal effort. It takes provider effort. You know, it takes effort from the community at large. And so as one of our goals is to make sure that we're expanding access to services and supports, we're looking out to the community to see what role do they play in helping to effectuate our vision of making North Dakota the healthiest state in the nation.
We're enjoying our conversation with Commissioner Wayne Salter. He's the executive director of the Department of Health and Human Services, appointed by Governor Burgum in January of this year. As you refine your business plan prior to its launch, Commissioner, what have you learned about North Dakota's biggest challenges that lay ahead to make North Dakota either more healthy or the healthiest place in the country?
You know, I think it's a challenge that, you know, other states experience. It is really battling with resources, you know, and making sure that we are properly staffed and resources to meet the needs. You know, we want to make sure as a state that we have an adequate provider network, that we have good concrete services and supports that are responsive to the community needs. And so I think that's going to ever be a challenge to do that. But I also think with, you know, effectuating good community partnerships, good relationship with our provider community, that we can begin to knit that safety net together to make it a stronger, more cohesive model for North Dakota.
I think all departments of health across the country during COVID came across a little bit of hurdle relative to public trust. How will the Health and Human Services Department, I guess, work to either build the public trust that is there or maybe repair some public trust that has now come up in states and even here in North Dakota relative to the Department of Health?
You know, as the new commissioner, I always get to hear, you know, people reach out to me all the time and they are not shy with letting me know the challenges that they've had with the agency, you know, in the last couple of years. You know, and I realize that the success of our agency is directly linked to the well-being and the trust of the people we serve. And so there's a couple of things that we're doing. One of the things that I'm really sharing with our team is that we're Health and Human Services. We are in the people business. People are our priority. You know, one of the biggest ways to diminish trust is being called and not being able to adequately respond. And so a lot of our effort now is really focused on organizational alignment. And that really means we've integrated these two agencies together. There should be some better customer experiences and outcomes because we're now joined. And so we're now taking time to really do that. And, you know, some would say, you know, Commissioner Salter, you've been very aggressive since your appointment in January. And I would respond, the people that we serve have some very aggressive needs, and we have to be aggressive to be able to keep pace with their needs and respond adequately to really build that trust. One of the first initiatives that we did in February, approximately 30 days after the appointment, I released our strategic framework. And this is how we operate as an organization. This is how we do business. These are our milestones that we want to work towards. It really gave the organization a sense of oneness now that we are integrated so everybody can march towards the same vision. You know, as we look at our resources, you know, again, trust comes by experience. If people have had not so good experiences with the agency, they're going to form an opinion. And so it's our role as a newly integrated agency to change that opinion. And the only way that we can change that opinion is to be proactive and to show up and adequately respond. So we're spending a lot of time looking at our resources. We're spending a lot of time looking at our skill sets. We're spending a lot of time looking at our technology to make sure that when North Dakotans who are in need call us, the agency that serves people, we can respond, and we can respond appropriately.
What are you doing relative to the accountability part of launching the business plan, launching the SHIP, so that North Dakotans will know you're doing what you said you would do, and here's how we can see that you're doing that?
Absolutely. Two of our guiding principles, one of it is open and transparent communication. You know, as a government agency, we have to be able to be open with our constituency, with our providers, with our stakeholders, with our legislative leadership. And that's something that we are definitely re-energizing within our organization. And the second thing, it really is that communication aspect. You know, people want to be engaged. The third thing is responsible stewardship. You know, we have over a $6 billion budget. And if you talk to any of my finance team, if you talk to my newly hired CFO, she will tell you that I've said, if our budget is $6,332,092, we will be accountable for the 92 cents. That's responsible stewardship. That's what the public expects of us. And so really being able to be transparent, to show people what we're doing, how we're doing it, how much it costs, how well we're managing our resources, our finances, to me, that adds credibility to our organization. You know, some would say that's a huge budget. That's a very large budget. It's the largest state agency budget. But when you think about it, we have over 150 programs and services. It's a large agency with a large responsibility. And so we're setting protocols in place where we can do that. We're redefining our budgeting process. We're creating different reports, different accountability mechanisms. So at any given moment, if someone wants to know, Department of Health and Human Services, what are you doing here? We can transparently show them, this is what we're doing. This is how we're performing. You know, I think it's a change in the culture, but I think it's one that we've needed for some time. And I honestly think that it's going to be a refreshing change for our communities to understand that we now have a responsive, proactive agency who's open and transparent with what they're doing. And so you'll be able to clearly see our metrics, our key performance indicators.
Is this on a website then?
It will be posted. It eventually, once we release it, it will be posted on the website. We want to be able to clearly show this is our goal, these are our objectives, and this is how well we're doing it. And the reality is, you know, there may be times when we do not meet one of our anticipated goals, and that's fine. We're going to be clear and transparent to say we fell short here, but here's what we're doing to make sure that we don't fall short again. Along with the business plan, we are working on divisional dashboards where people can clearly see how we're performing. Again, we don't want anybody to assume. You know, one of the things I also tell our teams is in the lack of information, people create their own realities. And if you've ever been in a position of leadership, you can spend about 85 to 90% of your time fixing realities that aren't really realities when we could have just provided the information up front. And so you'll see clearly defined dashboards. You'll see reporting mechanisms through our business plan. And we're going to proactively pump out information. You know, when we do good, we want to be able to tell the public, this is what we've done. You know, when we don't do something good, we want to be able to tell the public, this is what didn't go well. But here is what your trusted agency is doing to rectify it. Here's what we're doing to fix it. So you can expect to see more engaged communication coming out from our agency.
Commissioner, as we wrap up our discussion today, one of the things I wonder about is next year and 3 years and 5 years from now, because we will have a new executive leader in the state of North Dakota. We'll have a new governor. How do we know then that this work will move forward despite or with the support of a new governor?
The work that we're doing, it really is, it's work that everybody can agree to. I don't know that it matters who will be in that chair. Everybody agrees that in our state, chronic disease is an issue. Everybody agrees that in our state that we need to be a healthier state. You know, everybody agrees in our state that we have issues. We have behavioral health issues, and we need to tackle those mental health crises. You know, and so a lot of our services and programs, they're set on a trajectory. It is an agreed upon strategy that these are things that we need. In our leadership now and what we're trying to do, we want to set it up for years to come. You know, it goes beyond just 2, 3, 4, 5 years. You know, things that we are doing today, we will see incremental results, but they will really see the full impacts 5, 10, 15 years from now when we can look at, you know, what we've done through our SHIP. We can look at what we've done through our initiatives, and we see the lifespans of North Dakotans increase. We see the occurrence of chronic diseases decrease. So, you know, I don't think it's really relative to whomever the executive leader is. I think whomever it is, we can all agree that these are important challenges to all of us as North Dakotans.
Lastly, Commissioner, are you fairly confident that those listeners who are now living in rural North Dakota, who today have very different access to health care than I do living near Fargo, that they'll have what they need to support their physical and mental health?
You know, that's one of our priorities, right, is really the expansion of services. And so we are really looking strategically at those rural communities and figuring out how can we further expand on telehealth? You know, how can we get more providers? You know, again, that's part of the SHIP plan as well, is to strengthen the workforce. You know, we have to be strategic as a state, and we have to be intentional as a state of making sure that we don't overlook those rural communities.
Wayne Salter, he's the Executive Director of the Department of Health and Human Services. Commissioner, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding number 2 is about learning and storytelling. It states, traditional teaching and the passing on of knowledge and wisdom was done through storytelling, song, ceremony, and daily way of life, often incorporating specific gender and age-specific responsibilities. These continue to be some of the best modes for learning for both Native and non-Native learners.
In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll hear from Janet Claymore Ross, enrolled member of the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate, in part 1 of her story of Iktomi and the ducks.
Iktomi lived in a village, and he was not very nice. You know Iktomi. He's lazy, expects everybody to serve him. So he was sitting in the village one day, and he was saying, "Can I have some of your food?" And the person said, "You know, Iktomi, it's impolite for us to say no. But you have not helped us. You go out and you bring some food back, and I will fix it for you." "I'm not going to do that." So off he goes, and he found another village. Well, that village soon came to realize that Iktomi, again, was lazy. So he thought, "Well, I'm just going to go to another village. So I'll do that." So he gets up, and he starts walking and walking and walking. "I'm so tired. Those lazy people in that village didn't even give me anything to eat so that I could go on this trip. How lazy they are. It's a good thing I brought my drum. I can entertain myself." And so he's going up a hill, and he's singing a song. And as he looks down the hill, there's this beautiful pond. And on the pond, there's lots of ducks. Oh, good. I can eat. I can eat. I'm going to run down the road. Down. No. You know what? Maybe there's a better way to get those ducks. So he gets up again, and he starts running. Then he stops and goes, "Oh, I know what that way is." So he goes down the hill, and he's singing a song. And the ducks go, "Iktomi, Iktomi, let's fly away."
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with Seth Varner from Wandermore Publishing. He is on a mission to visit every incorporated town in North Dakota. What surprised him most about our Peace Garden State? We'll get that answer tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you can join us.